Understanding the heart, it's a good idea, right? It's not just for poets and mystics anymore. It's also the title of chiropractor and functional medicine practitioner Stephen Hussey's latest book. Stephen took a long, deep dive into heart health after experiencing a heart attack. The research is compelling, from evolutionary origins to our current situation living in a toxic and stress-filled world. Stay tuned. He'll be sharing the research and his own insights for heart health and recovery when needed. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Stephen, you weren't kidding when you titled your book Understanding the Heart. It's got so much wonderful information, and I appreciate it very much that you took the time to help others understand so well about what's going on. And I know you like starting a discussion on the heart and heart disease with evolutionary origins. So considering, I'd like to share a lot of what you've covered in your book. What is key to knowing regarding these origins, would you say?
I guess it's just an understanding of where we came from as humans, for like perspective of where humans were or human ancestors were for millions of years before we got civilization or invented civilization, and how that drastically changed our environments. Because physiology takes a long time to change evolutionarily. So if the environment of any living thing changes too fast, then it's really hard for that thing to adapt. And so if you look at our modern world, compared to the environment of humans, the majority of time humans have been on Earth, it's drastically different than what our physiology is used to. We went from, you know, pretty much being outside all the time on natural landscapes, under natural light, and eating natural food, to this very modern society with an evolutionarily quick amount of time. They say that the birth of civilizations was probably 12 to 14,000 years ago, which sounds like a long time ago, but evolutionarily, it was a very short amount of time ago compared to the millions of years that humans and their ancestors have been here. And so if we compare, you know, that environment to our environment now, where we're spending, the research shows, up to 93% of our time indoors for the average person, and we're eating processed foods that don't look like normal foods, or natural foods. We have unnatural light. We're not getting the natural sunlight or the circadian rhythm. We have unnatural toxins in our environment. We have non-native electromagnetic fields and wireless signals in our environment. So many different changes that our physiology is having trouble adapting to, and that's why we're seeing this epidemic of chronic disease, specifically heart disease, which is the number one killer. So that's my story, and that's what I focus on.
And you're sticking to it, and I'm glad you are, because even though a lot of that information is certainly well known, and I would have to say with the Tributaries audience, it's very, very well known. And yet, all the information in your book is certainly at a depth that a lot of people have not been able to either know or research or understand. In your book, you cite various capabilities of other species in adapting to environmental situations. Is there one capability in particular that comes to mind that might give a little insight to either the human heart or care for the heart?
I remember talking about naked mole rats, their ability to adapt to the subterranean climates that they live in, which are a bit colder and free of light. And one of their adaptions is that they can actually alter their metabolism in a way that slows it significantly so that they can survive at lower temperatures for longer amounts of time and low oxygen environments for a longer amount of time, because they're able to slow that metabolism, which is a unique thing among mammals, because most mammals can't do that. Most mammals have this very active metabolism, and they're warm-blooded because they're creating a lot of heat. And so we need that active metabolism to maintain itself. We can't slow our metabolism to the point like a naked mole rat can or other species can. And so for us, that does happen in a forced way because of environmental factors that are not conducive to our physiology, our kind of modern way of life. Then that can force us into a slower metabolism in an animal that can't really sustain that. And so that's something that I draw a relationship to as far as a heart attack, and how that can predispose us to a heart attack or even be the trigger that causes it, a heart attack from a metabolic or a autonomic nervous system point of view. So, yeah, it's very relevant to understand these differences and understand how that applies to how humans are living today. So if our environment forces us into changes in our physiology that we're not able to sustain, that can cause issues. And so it's really this mismatch between our modern way of life and our physiology. Most people will see that from a 10,000 foot view and they'll be like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But when you understand specific mechanisms as to why these changes in our way of life and our environments is leading to the exact things that we see when we see heart attacks, like plaque in arteries or chest pain or whatever, then you're like, oh, now it really makes sense. Now it really sets in.
Yes, and I want to get into some of those imbalances that you bring up because it really does change what and how we look at the heart and how we take care of it. Perhaps how we repair it and that sort of thing. But you just mentioned ANS, which is the autonomic nervous system. It is autonomic, and yet yogis for time immemorial have been shown to be able to affect that autonomic nervous system. Is that something you see that is going to be more practiced and necessary?
Definitely. I mean, that's one of the main focuses of, I think, how we achieve homeostasis or a state for which our body can create health. Because all life in this whole planet that we live on, and most likely the universe, though I don't pretend to know about the depths of the universe, is all oscillating. So all life on this earth is in tune with this oscillation that's happening. So whether that be the day-night cycle of the sun, whether that be the resonance or frequency of the earth that's resonating at 7.83 hertz, and it's oscillating as it does that, kind of like this beat, this wavelength in and out, you know, kind of like a heartbeat.
Sure.
There's so many aspects about this life that's supposed to be alternating, resonating, even like walking one side or the other. And the same is true for how our nervous systems are wired. We are supposed to be alternate in and out of sympathetic and parasympathetic. And we're really never in one or the other by itself. We just have more or lesser signaling from one or the other at a certain time, but there's always signaling from both, and it's supposed to create this balance. And so, again, all life is about this oscillation and be able to go back and forth, which is why this modern way of life, well, one aspect of why this modern way of life is so compatible with our physiology is because we are living under the same wavelength of light. Most people are anyways, you know, this blue light, LED, fluorescent light. We have the same temperature all the time. We go from temperature-controlled homes to temperature-controlled cars to temperature-controlled offices. You know, there's no variation in our life, less variation than there should be, I should say. And so that's creating this situation where our nervous system is not getting trained to oscillate, to go back and forth, and we get this imbalance. Usually the imbalance is like too many things that are stimulating this sympathetic aspect of the nervous system, this stress.
Right.
Piece of the nervous system,
yes.
And not stimulating enough of this non-stress or this parasympathetic. And we need to get into more of the parasympathetic to do healing, right? To have this resting time where our body is calm and not stressed so we can actually repair and heal and detox and things like that. But most of us in a modern way of life are getting all these signals of that we're in a threatening situation because
right.
These signals from outside of our body are not conducive to our physiology. So our physiology is like, oh, what is this? We need to be on alert all the time, and so we're staying in this kind of stress, fight, or flight mode, and there's not much time for healing. So just some examples of this. So like our bodies are just big sensory beings. They're sensing all aspects of our environment, internal environment in our body and external environment outside of our body. And those signals are being picked up by the body, various senses, way more than just our five senses. And those signals are communicated to the brain, some of them electromagnetically, some of them neurologically. The heart is a sensory organ itself. It's picking up certain aspects of our environment. And the brain is not in control of anything. The brain is just like the postal service. You know, it's receiving all the information, and it just reads the information on the letter. It doesn't change it, hopefully. We don't hope the post office doesn't change the information. But just it sees it, and then it sends it where it needs to go. And so if our brain is sending a signal through the autonomic nervous system to our body to be in a more stressed state, that's because of the signal that's receiving from our environment, whether that's our internal bodily environment or our external environment. if we need to change the signal the brain is sending to the body, we need to change the signals that the brain is getting. And so that means we have to look into our environment. So that means, do we have toxic relationships rather than loving relationships and supportive relationships? Does that mean we have this incompatible wireless signal that's a form of light that our body doesn't really know about? Is our body set to the day-night cycle of the sun? Are we introducing a bunch of toxin exposures? It goes on and on and on. Do we have good mitochondrial health? Do we have lots of scar tissue in our fascia? Like, what are the things breaking down the communication system on the inside of the body? And what is that communicating to our nervous system? So all those things is kind of how I see the nervous system. It's not this thing that the brain is in control of and signaling. No. It's only controlled by the environment.
Right.
If we want a different signal from the nervous system, we got to change our environment. And again, many aspects of our modern way of life, it's making it hard for our nervous system to have that calm signal where we can heal.
Yes, in that wide range of choices that we now have, we have to be very wise to make good choices. And, you know, one of the deeper dives that you've done in talking about the imbalanced stress response, which is one of the three imbalances that can create problems with the heart or for the heart, nitrous oxide is also needed to signal the parasympathetic, if my understanding is correct. And some of these drugs that they're giving people are slowing down or preventing a better production of nitrous oxide. So the ramifications of all of these things run so far and deep, don't they? I don't even know if we need to discuss that further other than, yes, that's a fact. But moving into our blood pressure and the heart rate variability, is looking at blood pressure as important, or rather more important than heart rate variability? I know I've been speaking with people from the Heart Math Institute for many, many years now, and that seems to be something that the general public isn't necessarily aware of, and yet it's so important.
Definitely. Well, I'll just the nitric oxide first. I'll just make some comments about that.
Great.
Yes, you're absolutely
Thank
right.
You.
Medications and many other aspects of our environment, specifically many toxin exposures, are interfering with our body's ability to, A, make enough nitric oxide, which is made in the endothelial cells that line the arteries, and B, once the nitric oxide is made, lots of it's being used up to quench this inflammation or oxidative stress that we're facing because of the toxin exposures. And so, yes, we have this deficiency of nitric oxide, and that is necessary for the parasympathetic signaling to get into heart tissue specifically. We need that molecule. So if we're in a very inflamed oxidative stress, I say low body charge, which means lack of electrons to the system.
Yes.
If we're in a low body charge state, then nitric oxide is not being produced as much, and also it's being used for things that we don't want to use it for. We don't want to have to use it for. We want to be able to use it for other things. So yes, absolutely. And that's one reason why low nitric oxide, high inflammation, oxidative stress, low body charge is one precursor to heart attacks, because we need that parasympathetic signaling to the heart to prevent heart attacks, and nitric oxide has a key role there. And then the conventional wisdom about heart rate variability is that it's a measure of balance in our autonomic nervous system. And I don't disagree with that, but I think it's more than that. It's actually a measure of what's called heart coherence. And if we have heart coherence, that will be reflected in our autonomic nervous system signaling from the brain to the body. So your heart has an electromagnetic field that's bigger than even the brain's. It's big in the first place because it has lots of mitochondria, almost 5,000 per cell, which is some of the densest mitochondria in any tissue in the body. But the brain is also as dense. The eyes are as dense, too. So why is the heart's field so much bigger? It's bigger because when you have an electromagnetic field like that and you have a vortex, or you spin or spiral in that field, it amplifies the field significantly. And that's what the heart's doing. Every time it contracts, it's spinning and vortexing. And so it amplifies that field to where it could be, I think the number is like 15, 16 feet away from the body. It can be picked up. Anyways, that field that the heart is emitting is what makes it a sensory organ. It's reaching out into our environment and sensing our environment. What we want it to be sensing is a more coherent environment, an environment that is naturally oscillating or giving us the correct emotions. I think it was back in the Heart Math Institute, they found that love and appreciation, love and gratitude give us the most coherence, whereas anger and resentment give us the least coherence. But then again, there's so many other things that signal that. You know, how synced up to we are we to the day-night cycle of the sun? How in contact with the earth are we? getting that resonance and electrons from the earth itself. Are we surrounded by loving relationships? Do we have metabolic health as far as like eating a whole foods diet and all that kind of stuff? Because the heart is not just picking up the external environment, it's picking up the internal environment. And so if we have lots of scar tissue or we have stored past trauma in our structured water around our fascia and things like that, or if we have poor mitochondrial health and mitochondria aren't oscillating, because that's what they are, those little oscillators, they're not oscillating well enough and communicating to each other, then we get this internal body incoherence, right? And so then the heart picks up on that, and the signals that the heart's picking up on is then communicating those signals neurologically and electromagnetically to the brain to tell it, hey, we're in this stressful, incoherent environment, or if we're doing the right things, we're in the coherent environment. That's what creates a healthy heart rate variability. And there's a reason that it's a variability. I keep talking a lot about oscillation and variation in environments and creating that rather than the same things all the time. The heart rate is not a metronome. It doesn't beat on the same frequency. It varies because that's what signals for health. The analogy I give is a baseball player. Before the inning, the baseball player is standing flat-footed, maybe tossing around to a few other players or whatever, but nothing's really coherent or ready, right? But then when the first pitch is about to be pitched and the batter's up there, the whole team is like on their toes, kind of moving back and forth in that athletic stance.
They're yes, yes.
Stagnant, right? They're ready to react. And every baseball player in the field is doing that, and they're all coherent. They know what they're going to do if the ball's hit here or there. They know how to react to the environment and try and get that player out, or in our analogy, is return to homeostasis. To me, that's what heart rate variability is measuring. It's really measuring coherence, which is reflected as autonomic balance. So
yes.
That makes sense.
Yes, and as you were speaking, I was thinking of it as floating on the ocean, because the waves keep undulating, but they're never the same size. They're just what they are, and you just want to be able to go with the flow, so to speak. What a novel idea.
Yeah, and like we are nature, right? So
yes.
That's a perfect or beautiful example of something happening in nature that is also us. Our heart rate variability should be like those waves.
Yes, and we will get to the heart and what it's really doing in the body. But first, because you did mention the structured water, if anyone in the audience is interested, I've done a couple of interviews with Dr. Gerald Pollack years ago, so they can go hear more about the structured water. But talk about it in reference to the heart and the energy. You mentioned, you know, of course, we're an electrical system, and that, I think, involves good salt that helps create and keeps the electrical charge going. And yet they say don't have salt if you're having a heart problem. So I'm wondering if you could just wrap a little bit around the structured water and how salt interacts with the heart and that sort of thing, and the importance of that structured water.
Definitely. Structured water, first of all, I'm sure listeners who may not know, it's basically this gel-like form of water. So we all know that water can exist as a liquid, as water, but also as steam and as ice. There's actually this fourth state, so they call it the fourth phase of water, which is more like a gel. So you can think like the consistency of raw egg white or jello, or you know, good bone broth you made with good gelatin. It'll be like a gelatinous material, which is why like if I touch my leg or I move the tissue of my forearm, it feels like a gel. I can move it and then it bounces right back to where it was, because most of the water in our cells is, in our body in general, is structured water. Is this gel-like form of water, or it should be at least. And so structured water is basically the water molecules that have kind of changed their structure a little bit. So it's not H2O, it's more H3O2, and it exists in like this gel-like state. We live on a water planet charged by the sun. All energy for life on this planet comes from the sun. Structured water is our mechanism by which we can store that energy. Water is a very unique liquid, and it can store energy. And the way that it does that is it becomes structured water. So it's no surprise that in Dr. Pollack's lab, like you mentioned, Dr. Gerald Pollack, they found that infrared light is the most structuring to water. So any wavelength of light from the sun will energize water or give it energy so that it becomes structured water. UV is the least effective at doing it, and infrared on the far other side of the spectrum is the most effective at doing it, which makes sense because any time the sun is up, it is 40 to 50% infrared light. So again, we are water beings. We're all told we're like 70, 80% water, but if you look at that molecular volume, we're like 99.9% water, and we're supposed to be charged by the sun. And so we can gain this energy from the sun, and it builds up a structured water. That's the energy storage form of the body, is the structured water. People think that it's ATP, And ATP does hold an energy storage bond, but it's really structured water that's holding most of our energy. And this is relevant to the heart because in places in the body where water is liquid, in the arteries or in the lymphatic tissue or in the cerebral spinal fluid and places like that, structured water requires a hydrophilic or water-loving surface to become structured water on. So in these places where there's liquid water, next to the artery wall, there's a layer of structured water if we have enough energy to the system. And so that does a few things. One, it protects the lining of the artery because one of the characteristics of structured water is that almost nothing can penetrate it. Only very small hydrated ions of minerals, potassium or smaller, can penetrate it. And so it protects the lining of the artery. But in Dr. Pollack's lab, they've shown that when structured water forms on the inside lining of a tube in a vat of water, it actually creates fluid flow. With no pump acting on it whatsoever, the water can move through the tube and start to move in. It'll move in that direction as long as it has sufficient energy to it, which is, in their lab, was an infrared bulb. Ours is the sun. And so if we get that energy there, then the fluid will move, which suggests that there are other ways that the blood in the body moves than a contracting heart, because the heart, to me, is not a pressure propulsion pump. That's not its
right.
job.
Next subject.
Yeah, and so that's very relevant because if we don't have these other fluid mechanisms happening for us and moving the fluid, which is keeping the lining of the arteries healthy, but also it takes pressure off the heart, right?
Yes.
Because that's not its job to be this pressure propulsion pump. So yeah, that's one reason that structured water is very relevant to the heart. But the other reason is that it helps prevent clotting. If we look at what atherosclerosis is, this plaque that lines the arteries in some people, or can happen for some people, it's primarily clotting tissue. There's this big idea that it's cholesterol that's survived for way too long, and there's never really any evidence, sound evidence anyways, in the beginning to prove that theory. But if you actually analyze plaque, it's made up of clotting tissue, which is just what happens in blood. Like if I cut my skin, my blood forms clotting tissue so that my body can heal that over time. It has to stop the bleeding so it can heal over time. And a similar process happens on the lining of the artery. If there's damage to it and the body can't repair it in time, then it develops this clotting tissue. And it actually happens inside the artery wall itself, in the lining of the artery. But that all happens if we have lack of structured water there, because the things that prevent clotting are adequate movement of blood, so stagnant blood clots. So if we want to create adequate movement of blood, we need structured water in the lining of the arteries, because that's what creates the movement, like they showed in Dr. Pollack's lab. But then the other aspect is that structured water doesn't just form on the lining of the artery, it forms around any hydrophilic surface, which means all the elements of blood itself, the red blood cells, the lipoproteins, various other proteins, anything that's in there, it's going to form structured water on them. And when it forms around them, because structured water is so electronegatively charged, it gives all the elements of blood this negative charge. And we all know that like charges repel each other. Mm-hmm. So if we want to create nice, fluid, not stagnant, not coagulated or clumping up blood, and keep all the elements of blood kind of equally spaced from each other, we need to charge it, give it that negative charge with building structured water, and that keeps things from clotting, right?
Right,
which
yes.
is the ultimate thing that causes strokes and heart attacks at the end of the day is clot. And so we want to prevent that, and that means put your body in an environment that gives it that energy to build structured water, which means feed on the earth, get sunlight exposure, get metabolic health, avoid toxins, avoid EMF, all that stuff.
Right. So I've also been on the path, Stephen, of researching the heart for many years, and 100% agree with you about how the heart works and what it's actually doing in the body. And it's been said that if the heart truly was that hydraulic pump moving all the blood, humans would need a heart the size of a whale's. Everyone who's listening that wants to understand the heart, how it works, how to be healthy with your heart, you can read the book. But let's just have a little bit of a discussion here talking about how and what it's doing with the two sides of the heart and how it's circulating and acting like a dam in a process.
Yeah, as you said, a heart the size of the one that we have, there's no way that it could create enough force to forcibly pump blood around the entire body and the 60,000 miles of arteries and veins that we have. It doesn't make sense, really. Like, if I was going to pump water up a hill from my feet to my head or even my feet just to my chest, I wouldn't put the pump at the top of the hill. I would put it at the bottom of the hill and pump it up the hill, right? And so, yeah, it doesn't really make sense that it's this pressure propulsion pump. And there's plenty of evidence that suggests that it's not. Like, if people need that sort of thing, like research evidence, there's a lot. If it's not a pump, then what is it? And it turns out it's this vortexing hydraulic ram is how it's supposed to function. And so I didn't know what a hydraulic ram was when I first heard that term. I had to go look it up on YouTube and get like a picture of it and a video that explained what it was. But it's, our hydraulic ram is basically something that's flow activated. So it means it needs flow of fluid into it for it to operate like it's supposed to. And it operates based off of changes in pressure. And there's a few differences between the heart and an engineering hydraulic ram, but it's pretty much the same sort of mechanism that happens. We already discussed how the flow can happen, how there's the structured water moving yes. the fluid. And so it's flow activated in that nature. But the job of the heart is to actually vortex the blood. The reason that we have this thing that's in the middle of the circulation, which is weird to think about. We have this thing in the middle of the circulation. If we wanted the blood to be circulating around uninterrupted, why would we put this thing in the middle of it to interrupt it? And there's a reason for that. It's because when animals came out of the ocean, the first animals that came out of the ocean had tidal currents and waves crashing on the beach and the movement of fluid, it was swishing around. And that's something that Dr. Pollack found in his lab, that swishing water around, vortexing it in the presence of oxygen is something else that energizes it so that it can become structured water next to a water-loving surface. And so when we came out of the ocean and we didn't have that from the ocean anymore, we needed a way to do that in our bodies. And so we have these hearts that can do that, can vortex the blood. When the blood flows into the chamber of the heart itself, it vortexes around, it kind of spirals around. The contraction of the heart is a spiral-like nature, so it kind of twists up on itself to create a spiral. When blood flows through the valves of the heart, the four different valves, it eddies on either side, creating turbulence and swishing the water around. So there's no mistake that we swish the water around, energize it, go and give it oxygen to the lungs and bring it right back to the heart and do it again. Right. And then we put it out to the circulation.
Yes.
So there's the heart is really two vortexing hydraulic rams next to each other. The right side of the heart and the left side of the heart are two different hydraulic rams. That's the first world heart to be this vortexing hydraulic ram. And the few differences are is that in like a hydraulic ram, there's a spill valve in the first chamber. Mm-hmm. So like the atria chamber, we don't really have a spill valve. And the second one is that the pumping, quote-unquote pumping effect of a hydraulic ram comes from pressure buildup in the second chamber that eventually gets so big that it pushes it out and the other way, whereas we don't necessarily have that pressure. We have some pressure buildup, but it's really a contracting ventricle, which is, you know, timed by the signaling from the brain to have that contraction. So there's two small differences. There's scientists back in the 1800s that tried to set up a pressure propulsion model of the vascular system like we had it. It didn't work. They couldn't use a pressure propulsion pump to make that system work. It had to be more of a hydraulic ram, like pressure change driven aspect of things. So that's the first role of the heart. The second is actually to slow the flow of blood during times of exertion. So there's really interesting studies where they increased the heart rate, but the cardiac output of blood did not change, right? So you think if we increased the heart rate, more blood would be quote unquote pumped out of the heart, but it's not. We increased the heart rate and the output is the same. There's just more contractions because the heart rate is actually driven by the flow rate. So like if we were to go exercise, the tissue demand for oxygen and nutrients and whatever else is in blood is so high that all the blood tries to rush over to the arterial side.
Right, right, yes.
If there was no heart there to slow the flow of blood from going over to the arterial side, the venous side would lose its pressure and it would collapse and we would die because you can't lose pressure in that system. Like this hydraulic system, you can't do that. And so the heart's job, and they've done some pretty cool studies on endurance athletes, marathoners, and soccer players. In those athletes, we get this cardiac hypertrophy. They think, oh, it's because they're using their heart so much and it's more effective at pumping, when in reality, they've shown that it's more effective at slowing the flow of blood.
Mm-hmm.
The reason the heart muscle tissue gets bigger is because it's like a bigger catcher's mitt to
yes.
slow the flow of blood.
Right.
And then put it back out to circulation. And so, yeah, that's why it's there to maintain pressure between two systems during exertion. And then the third role of the heart is, like we've already talked about, is to measure that coherence, to have that huge electromagnetic field that helps us sense our environment. And there's a reason we say things like, you know, we attach so many emotions to the heart. I love you with all my heart, not I love you with all my kidney or whatever. You know, we say heart because that's the organ that's helping us reach out and feel, right? So yeah, those are the three roles of the heart. And I always like to illustrate, like if that's something that modern medicine doesn't have a good grasp on, even though there's tons of published research in their medical literature that shows this. So if they don't understand the actual function of the heart, how are they supposed to understand what to do about it when something goes wrong, like in heart failure, which just goes to show why they're having such a hard time preventing and then also treating things like heart failure, because they don't understand the true function of the heart to begin with.
Exactly. I guess I'll try to get two more questions in for us today. Have you drawn any conclusions about why the heart and the brain are prone to blockages while the other organs aren't? And we all know now that with neurotransmitters and neural pathways, if one gets damaged in the brain, other ones show up. And the same goes for the heart. Arterial highways start getting created and born in the body when something gets blocked. So does that say, okay, then stents are totally silly to do? Or how do you want to answer that?
Well, I mean, as far as why we get what are called infarcts, blockages or clots that can restrict blood flow to an area, why we see those in the heart and the brain, it's primarily the heart we see them by far. And then we can also see them secondary as we get strokes, we get those in the brain. But we get infarcts anywhere in the body. There's liver infarcts, there's kidney infarcts. We see them lots of places. To me, why they're so common in the heart is because the heart arteries are under the most pressure. So if we create a situation where there's a clotting issue or a predisposed to clotting, it makes sense that the arteries under the most pressure would be more likely to have that clotting response. And then strokes, the blood that comes out of the heart goes back into the heart itself first, and then it goes straight up into the arteries that go up into the brain. Those are some of the first places it goes to. So if we have clotting issues, then that can happen there. But I also think there's something more when it comes to stroke. There's this microvascular disease. So it's actually more of a disease of like the small blood vessels. And they call those like transient ischemic attacks, but I think that it's similar there. But the real issue here is clotting. You know, whenever you go in for a stroke or heart attack, they're giving you blood thinners and clot-busting enzymes. They're not giving you cholesterol-busting enzymes and things, because that's what the thing at the end of the day that happens. And so we want to prevent clotting by keeping the blood, quote-unquote, thin from a biophysics perspective, like we talked about with the grounding and the building structure of water and things like that. Yeah, and then the other thing is, like you mentioned, there's all this research showing that we can build collaterals. And most cardiologists acknowledge this because they see people who have robust collaterals. But what they don't know is that, or at least the cardiologists that I've met know, there's this work of Dr. Giorgio Beraldi. His work pretty much showed that anybody who develops a gradual forming stenosis or blockage over time, as long as it's a slow, gradual thing, the body will compensate for it. It'll build new collaterals, arteries around that blockage. So anytime you get to about 60 or 70% narrowed, the body starts to build these new arteries, according to Beraldi's research. That doesn't mean that I haven't met people that seem to have these blockages. They get symptoms, and it's like, where are their collaterals? And I don't know, but Beraldi's work showed that it's really common for that to happen.
Yes.
There's also a completely different mechanism of the chest pain and angina that has to do with the nervous system again. But yeah, so yeah, the body does build these collaterals. And as you alluded to, yes, that does make us question the validity of the use of stents. You know, it's interesting. The research is pretty clear. And cardiologists will tell you this too, or at least some of the ones I know will tell you this. But so they have tons of plaque in their arteries, right? But they're asymptomatic. I just talked with someone the other day who had 100% blockage that they found incidentally, right? They just found it because they were doing scans, but he had no symptoms whatsoever. He had 100% blockage because the body had likely built collaterals around that area and compensated the heart with blood. In those situations where someone has all this plaque but they're asymptomatic, or the research even shows that they have stable symptoms, like they maybe have chest pain but it's very stable, it's not worsening, and it's very reliably produced and it's not happening with less activity or whatever, the research is clear that the elective stent procedures, so stents placed at a time we're not having a heart attack, or bypass procedures, those are things to use to treat those plaques to prevent future heart attacks. The research says that those procedures don't prevent future heart attacks. Whether someone has the procedure or not, they're just as likely to have a heart attack. And to me, that's because, well, there's one major mechanism other than a blocked artery that causes a heart attack, and they're not addressing that when they put a stent in there. The other reason that they give them the wrong advice, they tell them to go home and take medications and eat a low-fat diet and all this stuff, and it's like, well, that's not the right advice.
Right.
And they don't tell them to avoid toxins or get structured water or anything like that. But yeah, like we're chasing down this plaque, right? And we're measuring the plaque and treating it if it gets quote unquote bad enough. When in reality, those procedures haven't really been shown to be that effective. Doesn't mean they're never useful, but we're definitely overusing them. We're putting foreign bodies and doing traumatic surgeries on people when we really don't need to in many cases.
Yes.
But yeah, it's definitely an interesting twist to the main theories of what cardiology does today.
Right. Well, I thank you so much for writing your book, because it's going to help bring this out more and more and start bigger and better questions for what's going on. And if I can, there's something in me that always wants to be an advocate or cheerleader for the lymph system. I don't know why, but maybe because it's so A, misunderstood, and B, underrepresented in what it is there for the body. What is a key about the heart getting first dibs on the fatty acids that travel via the lymph system? And what have you found to assist in keeping a good, healthy lymph system?
First of all, the same mechanism we talked about with structured water that happens in the arteries, that's how the lymph moves. We don't have a heart for the lymph, right? So how does the lymph move? We're told it's muscle contraction or things like that, but it's really the structured water mechanism. So we need to get adequate structured water to make sure that lymph highway is moving. And yeah, like you mentioned and I talked about in the book, like the fatty acids get absorbed and they're put into these things called chylomicrons, which are so big they can't necessarily get absorbed through the gut very well, so they're put into the lymph system. And then the lymph system drains into the veins that drain into the heart. Those fatty acids get dumped right before they go into the heart, and then they get vortexed once in the right, and then they go to the lungs and they get oxygen, and they come back to the left side of the heart, and they're put right out into circulation. And then the first thing that the blood does when it goes into circulation is go back to the heart itself, the coronary arteries that feed the heart itself. So, yeah, it's almost like the blood is primed going through the system, and then it's the first dibs get to the heart. And the heart prefers to burn fatty acids over carbohydrates. Like, even in the presence of carbohydrates, studies show that the heart tissue will choose fatty acids to burn and ketones because it's much more efficient, which makes sense. We have this organ that's having to constantly contract. We need the most efficient fuel source we can get. And then, yeah, the movement of the lymph system is critical. That's one of our main detoxification systems. So we need that to be moving adequately. And stagnant fluid flow anywhere in the body is just a recipe for inflammation and disease. And again, it makes sense. What is nature doing to fluid or water in this world? It's moving it. It's never stagnant, never staying still. And when it does get stagnant, like a pond is always kind of gross looking, you know?
Yes.
or a puddle, it kind of accumulates dirt and debris and bacteria. It's like we need things to be moving. You look at a river that's flowing, it's beautiful. It's always beautiful. That's the same thing in the bodies. We got to take out the trash, not just like if we have extra toxins and things, but the cellular debris from doing physiology. We have waste products that we need to get rid of, and that's all put into the lymph. So we need to move the lymph, and we need to sweat it out. We need to support the kidneys and the liver and all that kind of stuff, and that means keeping things moving, nothing stagnant. And you could say the same with energetics. You know, we need to keep energy flowing. The same as we need to keep fluid flowing. Nature gave us those things. We have feet on the earth and we're under infrared light all day long. Like even in the shade, you're getting infrared exposure. Then fluid's just moving all the time. The other thing that's really amazing for lymph flow is good, adequate, deep sleep. So we need to make sure we're getting deep sleep, which comes down to setting your circadian rhythm, being very conscious of when you're exposed to light, artificial light, especially blue light, so that you can get enough melatonin, so that you get into that deep sleep, so that your body cleans house at night. Because, you know, 3-4 nights of not getting that deep sleep and not getting the lymph flow and taking out the trash is like, all right, that's not ideal, but it's not going to kill you. But a lifetime of that, like you never took the trash out in your house. Like one day you're going to wake up in that house and you're like, I can't live here anymore.
Right, yes.
Because there's too much trash. So it's a very similar thing. We got to support the lymph to get things out.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole cholesterol theory, the medical system is so focused on measuring those lipid numbers. When you learn about the history of the cholesterol kind of lipid theory, you realize there was really no sound evidence to begin with. I'm not saying it's irrelevant, but it's not the driver. And the biggest issue for me is the giant distraction from the actual causes of heart disease, which hopefully people got a sense of in this conversation today. There's many more aspects of the heart disease than just measuring this number on the test and trying to make it look good, quote unquote, good, you know.
And let me ask you, how are you? Do you sound well?
I'm feeling great.
Good.
There's more to the story of my journey than what's in the book, just because time keeps happening.
So, of course.
but yeah, I'm feeling very good, and I've been very successful at reversing heart disease in my body, which medical doctors told me was impossible to do without medication. Even with medications, they told me it was impossible, but I did it without medications.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing that and for sharing.
Pretty interesting that the power that we can have when we do the right things, put the body in the right environment, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do hope that poetic heartbreak doesn't eventually come down to lack of good fats or fatty acids.
Yeah.
The romantic in all of us would suffer greatly, I think.
I think so, too.
Stephen Hussey, author of Understanding the Heart, has agreed to share more on our next broadcast, discussing what he's been doing to successfully reverse his heart damage and how we can take better care of our hearts. For anything we do here, archives, guest information, and more, it's tributariesradio.com, and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.